Chapter 47 Athaclena. It was all up to Benjamin now. Athaclena and Robert watched from cover up on the slopes as their friend approached the grounded Gubru convoy. Two other Chims accompanied Benjamin, one holding high a flag of truce. Its device was the same as the symbol for the library, the rayed spiral of galactic civilization. The Chim emissaries had doffed homespun and were now decked out in silvery, formal robes, cut in a style appropriate for bipeds of their form and status. It took courage to approach this way. Although the vehicles were disabled, there had not been a sign of activity for more than half an hour. The three Chims had to be wondering what the enemy would do.
10-1, the birds try using a robot first, Robert muttered, his eyes intent on the scene below.
Athaclena shook her head.
No bet, Robert. Notice? The door to the center barge is opening.
From their vantage point, they could survey the entire clearing. The wreckage of the Howlett Center buildings loomed darkly over one still-smoldering hover tank. Its sister, useless barrels drooping, lay canted on its shattered pressure skirts. In between the two wrecked fighting machines, from one of the disabled barges, a floating shape emerged.
Right, Robert sniffed in disgust. It was indeed a robot.
It, too, carried a flapping banner, another depiction of the rayed spiral.
Damn, birds won't admit Chims are above the level of groundworms, not unless they're forced to, Robert commented. They'll try to use a machine to handle the parley. I only hope Benjamin remembers what he's supposed to do.
Athaclena touched Robert's arm, partly to remind him to keep his voice down.
He knows, she said softly. And he has Elaine Sue to help him.
Nevertheless, they shared a formless feeling of helplessness as they watched. This was patron-level business. Clients should not be asked to face a situation such as this alone. The floating drone, apparently one of the Gubru's sample collection bots, hastily adapted to diplomatic functions, came to a halt 4 meters from the advancing Chims, who had already stopped and planted their banner. The robot emitted a squeal of indignant chatter that Athaclena and Robert could not quite make out. The tone, however, was peremptory. Two of the Chims backed up a step, grinning nervously.
"You can do it, Ben," Robert growled.
Athaclena saw Knot stand out in his well-muscled arms. If those bulges had been Timbrimmy change glands instead, she shivered at the comparison and looked back to the scene below. Down in the valley, Chim Benjamin stood rock still, apparently ignoring the machine. He waited. At last, its tirade ran down. There was a moment of silence. Then Benjamin made a simple arm motion, exactly as Athaclena had taught him, contemptuously dismissing the non-living from involvement in sapient affairs. The robot squawked again, this time louder, and with a trace of desperation. The Chims simply stood and waited, not even deigning to answer the machine.
"What hauteur!" Robert sighed. "Good going, Ben. Show 'em you got class."
Minutes passed. The tableau held.
"This convoy of Gubru came into the mountains without psi shields,"
Athaclena announced suddenly. She touched her right temple as her corona waved.
"That or the shields were wrecked in the attack. Either way, I can tell they are growing nervous."
The invaders still possessed some sensors. They would be detecting movement in the forest, runners drawing nearer. The second assault group would arrive soon, this time bearing modern weapons.
The resistance had kept its greatest power in reserve for the sake of surprise. Antimatter tended to give off resonances that were detectable from a long way away. Now, though, it was time to show all of their cards. By now the enemy would know they were not safe, even within their armored craft. Abruptly, and without ceremony, the robot rose and fled to the center barge. Then, after a brief pause, the lock cycled open again, and a new pair of emissaries emerged.
"Quacku," Robert announced.
Athoclenus suppressed the glyph Sirtunu. Her human friend did have a propensity for proclaiming the obvious. The fluffy white quadrupeds, loyal clients of the Gubru, approached the parley point, gobbling to each other excitedly. They loomed large as they arrived in front of the chims. A vodor hung from one thick, feathery throat, but the translator machine remained silent. The three chims folded their hands before themselves and bowed as one, inclining their heads to an angle of about 20 degrees. They straightened and waited. The Quacku just stood there. It was apparent who was ignoring whom this time. Through the binoculars, Athoclenus saw Benjamin speak. She cursed the need to watch all this without any way to listen in. The chim's words were effective, however. The Quacku chirped and blatted in flustered outrage. Through the vodor came words too faint to pick out, but the results were nearly instantaneous. Benjamin did not wait for them to finish. He and his companions picked up their banner, turned about, and marched away.
"Good fellow," Robert said in satisfaction.
He knew chims. Right now their shoulder blades must be itching terribly, yet they sauntered coolly. The lead Quacku stopped speaking. It stared, nonplussed. Then it began hopping and giving out sharp cries. Its partner, too, seemed quite agitated. Now those on the hill could hear the amplified voice of the Vodor, commanding,
"Come back!"
over and over again. The chims continued walking toward the line of trees until, at last, Athoclenna and Robert heard the word.
"Come back! Please!"
Human and Timbrimi looked at each other and shared a smile. That was half of what this fight had been about. Benjamin and his party halted abruptly. They turned around and sauntered back. With the spiral standard in place once more, they stood silently, waiting. At last, quivering from what must have been terrible humiliation, the feathered emissaries bowed. It was a shallow bow, hardly a bending of 2 out of 4 knees, but it served. Indentured clients of the Gubru had recognized as their equals the indentured clients of human beings.
"They might have chosen death over this," Athoclenna whispered in awe, though she had planned for this very thing. "The Quacku are nearly 60,000 Earth years old. Neo-chimpanzees have been sapient for only 3 centuries, and are the clients of wolflings."
She knew Robert would not be offended by her choice of words.
"The Quacku are far enough along in uplift that they have the right to choose death over this. They and the Gubru must be stupefied and have not thought out the implications. They probably can barely believe it is happening."
Robert grinned. "Just wait till they hear the rest of it. They'll wish they'd chosen the easy way out." The chims answered the bow at the same angle. Then, with that distasteful formality out of the way, one of the giant avioids spoke quickly, its vodor mumbling an Anglic translation.
"The Quacku are probably demanding to speak with the leaders of the ambush," Robert commented,
and Athoclenna agreed. Benjamin betrayed his nervousness by using his hands as he replied, but that was no real problem. He gestured at the ruins, at the destroyed hover tanks, at the helpless barges, and the forest on all sides, where vengeful forces were converging to finish the job.
He's telling them he is the leader.
That was the script, of course. Athaclena had written it, amazed all the while how easily she had adapted from the subtle Timbrimi art of dissemblement to the more blatant human technique of outright lying. Benjamin's hand gestures helped her follow the conversation. Through empathy and her own imagination, she felt she could almost fill in the rest.
"We have lost our patrons," Benjamin had rehearsed saying. "You and your masters have taken them from us. We miss them and long for their return. Still, we know that helpless mourning would not make them proud of us. Only by action may we show how well we have been uplifted. We are, therefore, doing as they have taught us, behaving as sapient creatures of thought and honor. In honor's name, then, and by the codes of war, I now demand that you and your masters offer their parole, or face the consequences of our legal and righteous wrath."
"He is doing it,"
Athaclena whispered, half in wonder. Robert coughed as he tried not to laugh aloud. The Kwaku seemed to grow more and more distressed as Benjamin spoke. When he finished, the feathery quadrupeds hopped and squawked. They puffed and preened and objected loudly. Benjamin, though, would not be bluffed. He referred to his wrist chronometer, then spoke three words. The Kwaku suddenly stopped protesting. Orders must have arrived, for all at once they bowed again, swiveled, and sped back to the center barge at a gallop. The sun had risen above the line of hills to the east. Splashes of morning light blazed through the lanes of shattered trees. It grew warm out on the parley ground, but the Chims stood and waited. At intervals, Benjamin glanced to his watch and called out the time remaining. At the edge of the forest, Athaclena saw their special weapons team begin setting up their only antimatter projector. Certainly the Gubru were aware of it, too. She heard Robert softly counting out the minutes. Finally, in fact nearly at the very last moment, the hatches of all three hovercraft opened. From each emerged a procession. The entire complement of Gubru, dressed in the glistening robes of senior patrons, led the way. They crooned a high-pitched song, accompanied by the basso of their faithful Kwaku. The pageantry was steeped in ancient tradition. It had its roots in epochs long before life had crawled ashore on the earth. It wasn't hard to imagine how nervous Benjamin and the others must feel as those to be paroled assembled before them. Robert's own mouth felt dry. "Remember to bow again," he urged in a whisper. Athaclena smiled, having the advantage of her corona.
"Have no fear, Robert. He will remember."
And, indeed, Benjamin folded his hands before him in the deeply respectful fashion of a junior client greeting a senior patron. The Chims bowed low. Only a flash of white betrayed the fact that Benjamin was grinning from ear to ear.
"Robert," she said, nodding in satisfaction, "your people have done very well by theirs in only 400 years.
"Don't give us the credit," he answered. "It was all there in the raw from the start." The paroled avians departed toward the valley of the Sindh on foot. No doubt they would be picked up before long. Even if they were not, Athaclena had ordered that word go out. They were to reach home base unmolested. Any Chim who touched one feather would be outlawed, his plasm dumped into sewers, his gene line extinguished. The matter was that serious. The procession disappeared down the mountain road. Then the hard work began. Crews of Chims hurried to strip the abandoned vehicles in the precious time remaining before retribution arrived. Gorillas chuffed impatiently, grooming and signing to one another as they awaited loads to carry off into the hills. By then, Athaclena had already moved her command post to a spine-covered ridge 2 miles farther into the mountains. She watched through binoculars as the last salvage was loaded and hauled away, leaving nearly empty hulks under the shadows of the ruined buildings. Robert had left much earlier, at Athaclena's insistence. He was departing again on another mission tomorrow and needed to get his rest. Her corona waved, and she kenned Benjamin before his softly slapping feet could be heard padding up the trail. When he spoke, his voice was somber.
"General, we've had word by semaphore that the attacks in the Sind failed. A few E.T. construction sites were blown up, but the rest of the assault was nearly a total disaster."
Athaclena closed her eyes. She had expected as much. They had too many security problems down below, for one thing. Vibben had suspected the town-side resistance was compromised by traitors. And yet, Athaclena had not disallowed the attacks. They had served a valuable purpose by distracting the Gubru defense forces, keeping their quick-reaction fighters busy far from here. She only hoped that not too many Chims had lost their lives, drawing the invaders' ire.
"The day balances out," she told her aide.
Their victories would have to be symbolic, she knew. To try to expel the enemy with forces such as theirs would be futile. With her growing knack at metaphors, she likened it to a caterpillar attempting to move a tree.
"No, what we win, we will achieve through subtlety."
Benjamin cleared his throat. Athaclena looked down at him.
"You still do not believe we should have let them leave alive," she told him.
He nodded.
"No, sir, I do not. I think I understand some of what you told me about symbolism and all that, and I'm proud you seem to think we handled the parole ceremony all right. But I still believe we should have burned them all."
"Out of revenge?"
Benjamin shrugged. They both knew that was how the majority of the Chims felt. They couldn't care less about symbols. The races of Earth tended to look upon all the bowing and fine class distinctions of the Galactics as the mincing foolishness of a mired, decadent civilization.
"You know that's not what I think," Benjamin said. "I'd go along with your logic about us scoring a real coup here today just by getting them to talk to us, if it weren't for one thing."
"What thing is that?"
"The birds had a chance to snoop around the center. They saw traces of uplift. And I can't rule out the possibility they caught a glimpse of the gorillas themselves through the trees."
Benjamin shook his head.
"I just don't think we should have allowed them to walk out of here after that," he said.
Athaclena put a hand on her aide's shoulder. She did not speak because there did not seem to be anything to say. How could she explain it to Benjamin? Sealf Kuan took form over her head, whirling with satisfaction at the progress of things, things her father had planned. No, she could not explain to Benjamin that she had insisted on bringing the gorillas along, on making them part of the raid, as a step in a long-involved and very practical joke. Chapter 48 Vibben and Galet.
"Keep your head down,"
Vibben growled.
"Will you stop snapping at me?"
Galet answered hotly. She lifted her eyes just to the tops of the surrounding grass stems.
"I just want to see if..."
The words cut off as Fibbin swept her supporting arms out from under her. She landed with a grunt of expelled air and rolled over, spitting dirt.
"You pit-scratching flea-bitten!"
Her eyes remained eloquent even with Fibbin's hand clamped firmly over her mouth.
"I told you," he whispered. "But their sensors, if you can see them, it means they've got to see you. Our only chance is to crawl like worms until we can find a way to blend back into the civilian Chim population."
From not far away came the hum of agricultural machinery. The sound had drawn them here. If they could only get close enough to mingle with the farmers, they might yet escape the invaders' dragnet. For all Fibbin knew, he and Galet might be the only survivors of the ill-fated uprising in the valley. It was hard to imagine how the mountain guerrillas under Athoclena's command could have done any better. The insurrection seemed all washed up from where he lay. He drew back his hand from Galet's mouth. "If looks could kill," he thought, contemplating the expression in her eyes. With her hair matted and mud-splattered, she was hardly the picture of the serene Chimmy intellectual.
"I thought you said," she whispered deliberately, emphasizing calmness, "that the enemy couldn't detect us if we wear only native-made materials. That's if they're being lazy and only counting on their secret weapon. But don't forget, they've also got infrared, radar, seismic sonar, psi."
He stopped suddenly. A low whine approached from his left. If it was the harvester they had heard before, there might be a chance to catch a ride.
"Wait here," he whispered.
Galet grabbed his wrist.
"No, I'm coming with you."
She looked quickly left and right, then lowered her eyes.
Don't leave me alone."
Fibbin bit his lip.
"All right, but stay down low, right behind me."
They moved single file, hugging the ground. Slowly the whine grew louder. Soon Fibbin felt a faint tingling up the back of his neck.
"Gravitics," he thought. "It's close."
How close, he didn't realize, until the machine slipped over the grass tops, coming into view just 2 meters away. He had been expecting a large vehicle, but this thing was about the size of a basketball and was covered with silvery and glassy knobs, sensors. It bobbed gently in the afternoon breeze, regarding them.
"Oh, hell!"
He sighed, sitting up on his haunches and letting his arms drop in resignation. Not far away, he heard faint voices. No doubt, this thing's owners.
"It's a battle drone, isn't it?"
Galet asked tiredly. He nodded.
"A sniffer. Cheap model, I think, but good enough to find and hold us." "What do we do?"
He shrugged.
"What can we do? We'd better surrender."
Behind his back, however, he sifted through the dark soil. His fingers closed around a smooth stone. The distant voices were coming this way.
"What the heck?" he thought. "Listen, Galet. When I move, duck. Get out of here. Get your notes to Athoclena if she's still alive."
Then, before she could ask any questions, he let out a shout and hurled the stone with all his might. Several things happened all at once. Pain erupted in Fibbin's right wrist. There was a flash of light, so bright that it dazzled him. Then, during his leap forward, countless stinging pinpricks rained up and down his chest. As he sailed toward the thing, a sudden strange feeling overcame Fibbin, one that said he had performed this act before, lived this particular moment of violence, not once or twice, but 100 times in 100 prior lives. The wave of familiarity, hooked on the flickering edge of memory, washed over him as he dove through the drone's pulsing gravitic field to wrap himself over the alien machine. The world bucked kicked and spun, as the thing tried to throw him off. Its laser blasted at his shadow, and grass fires broke out. Fibbon held on for his life, as the fields of the sky blended in a sickening blur. The induced sense of déjà vu actually seemed to help. Fibbon felt as if he had done this countless times. A small, rational corner of his mind knew that he hadn't, but the memory misfunction said different, and gave him a false confidence he badly needed right then, as he dared to loosen the grip of his injured right hand and fumbled for the robot's control box. Ground and sky merged. Fibbon tore a fingernail prying at the lid, breaking the lock. He reached in, grabbed wires. The machine spun and careened, as if sensing his intention. Fibbon's legs lost their grip and whipped out. He was whirled around like a rag doll. When his left hand gave way, he held on only by a weakening grip on the wires themselves, round and round and round. At that moment, only one thing in the world was not a blur, the lens of the robot's laser, directly in front of him. Goodbye, he thought, and closed his eyes. Then something tore loose. He flew away, still holding wires in his right hand. When crunching impact came, it was almost anticlimactic. He cried out and rolled up just short of one of the smoldering fires. Oh, there was pain, all right. Fibbon's ribs felt as if one of the big female gorillas at the Howlett Center had been affectionate with him all night. He had been shot at least twice. Still, he had expected to die. No matter what came after this, it was good just to be alive. He blinked away dust and soot. 5 meters away, the wreckage of the alien probe hissed and sputtered inside a ring of blackened, smoking grass. So much for the vaunted quality of galactic hardware. What E.T. shyster sold the Goobru that piece of shit? Fibbon wondered. I don't care. Even if it was a Jofer made of 10 smelly sap rings, I'd kiss him right now. I really would. Excited voices, running feet. Fibbon felt a sudden hope. He had expected Goobru to come after their downed probe, but these were Chims. He winced and held his side as he managed to stand. He smiled. The expression froze on his face when he saw who was approaching. Well, well, what do we have here? Mr. Blue Card himself. Looks like you've been running more obstacle courses, college boy. You just don't seem to know when you're beat. It was a tall Chen with carefully shaved facial hair and a mustache, elegantly waxed and curled. Fibbon recognized the leader of the probationer gang at the Ape's Grape, the one calling himself Iron Grip. Of all the Chims in the world, why did it have to be him? Others arrived. The bright zip suits bore an added feature, a sash, an arm patch, each bearing the same sigil, a claw outstretched, 3 sharp talons glistening in holographic threat. They gathered about him, carrying modified saber rifles, obviously members of the new collaborator's militia he and Galet had heard rumors of. "Remember me, college boy?" Iron Grip asked, grinning. "Yes, I thought you would. I sure do remember you." Fibbon sighed as he saw Galet Jones brought forward, held firmly by 2 other probationers. "Are you all right?" she asked softly. He could not read the expression in her eyes. Fibbon nodded. There seemed to be little to say. "Come on, my young genetic beauties," Iron Grip laughed as he took Fibbon hard just above his wounded right wrist. "We've got some people we want you to meet. And this time, there won't be any distractions." Fibbon's gaze was torn away from Galet's as a jerk on his arm sent him stumbling. He lacked the strength to put up a useless struggle. As his captors dragged him ahead of Galet, he had his first chance to look around, and saw that they were only a few 100 meters from the edge of Port Helena, A pair of wide-eyed chims in work dungarees watched from the running boards of a nearby cultivator. Fibbon and Galet were being taken toward a small gate in the alien wall, the barrier that undulated complacently over the countryside, like a net settled firmly over their lives. Chapter 49 Galactics. The suzerain of propriety displayed its agitation by huffing and dancing a brief series of hops on its perch of declamation. The half-formed squirms had actually delayed appearing before its judgment, withholding the news for more than a planetary rotation. True, the survivors of the mountain ambush were still in shock. Their first thought had been to report to military command. And the military, busy cleaning up the last of the abortive insurrections in the nearby flatlands, had made them wait. What, after all, was a minor scuffle in the hills compared with a nearly effective assault on the deep space defense battery? The suzerain could well understand how such mistakes were made, and yet it was frustrating. The affair in the mountains was actually far more significant than any of the other outbreaks of wild guerrilla warfare.
"You should have extinguished, caused an end, eliminated yourselves."
The suzerain chirped and danced out its chastisement before the Gubru scientists. The specialists still looked ruffled and unpreened from their long trek out of the hills. Now they slumped further in dejection.
"In accepting parole, you have injured, caused harm, reduced our propriety and honor,"
the suzerain finished chiding. If they had been military, the High Priest might have demanded reparations from these and their families. But most of their escorts had been killed, and scientists were often less concerned or knowledgeable in matters of propriety than soldiers. The suzerain decided to forgive them.
"Nevertheless, your decision is understood, is given sanction. We shall abide by your parole."
The technicians danced in relief. They would not suffer humiliation or worse upon returning to their homes. Their solemn word would not be repudiated. The parole would be costly, however. These scientists had to depart from the Garth system at once and not be replaced for at least a year. Furthermore, an equal number of human beings had to be released from detention. The suzerain suddenly had an idea. This brought on a rare flutter of that strange emotion, amusement. It would order 16 humans freed, all right, but the mountain chimpanzees would not be reunited with their dangerous masters. The released humans would be sent to Earth. That would certainly satisfy the propriety of the parole. The solution would be expensive, true, but not nearly as much as letting such creatures loose again on the main continent of Garth. It was stunning to contemplate that neo-chimpanzees might have achieved what these reported they had done in the mountains. How could it be? The proto-clients they had observed in town and in the valley hardly seemed capable of such finesse. Might there, indeed, be humans out there still? The thought was daunting, and the suzerain did not see how it would be possible. According to census figures, the number unaccounted for was too small to be significant anyway. Statistically, all of those should simply be dead. Of course, the gas bombings would have to be stepped up. The new suzerain of Cost and Caution would complain, for the program had proved very expensive. But now the suzerain of Propriety would side with the military completely. There was a faint stirring. The suzerain of propriety felt a twinge inside. Was it an early sign of a change of sexual state? It should not begin yet, when things were still so unsettled, and dominance not yet decided among the three peers. The molting must wait until propriety had been served, until consensus had been reached, so that it would be clear who was the strongest. The suzerain chirped a prayer to the lost progenitors, and the others immediately crooned in response. If only there was some way to be sure which way the battles were going, out in the galactic swirl. Had the Dolphin ship been found yet? Were the fleets of some alliance, even now approaching the returned ancient ones, to call up the end of all things? Had the time of change already begun? If the priest were certain that galactic law had indeed broken down irreparably, it would feel free to ignore this unpalatable parole and its implied recognition of neo-chimpanzee sapiency. There were consolations, of course. Even with humans to guide them, the near animals would never know the right ways to take advantage of that recognition. That was the way of wolfling-type species. Ignoring the subtleties of the ancient galactic culture, they barged ahead using the direct approach, and nearly always died.
Consolation, it chirped. Yes, consolation and victory.
There was one more matter to take care of. Potentially the most important of all. The priest addressed the leader of the expedition again.
Your final parole agreement was to avoid, to abjure, to forswear ever visiting that site again.
The scientists danced agreement. One small place on the surface of Garth was forbidden the Gubru until the stars fell, or until the rules were changed.
And yet, before the attack, you found, did uncover traces of mysterious activity, of gene meddling, of secret uplift?
That, too, had been in their report. The suzerain questioned them carefully about details. There had only been time for a cursory examination, but the hints were compelling. The implications, staggering. Up in those mountains, the chimpanzees were hiding a pre-sentient race. Prior to the invasion, they and their human patrons had been engaging in uplift of a new client species. So, the suzerain danced. The data recovered from the Timbrimi cairn was no lie. Somehow, by some miracle, this catastrophe world had given birth to a treasure. And now, in spite of Gubru mastery of the surface and the sky, the Earthlings continued to hoard their discovery to themselves. No wonder the planetary branch library had been ransacked of its uplift files. They had tried to hide the evidence.
But now, the suzerain rejoiced, we know of this wonder. You are dismissed, released, set upon your ships for home,
it told the bedraggled scientists. Then the suzerain turned to its Kwaku aides, gathered below its perch.
Contact the suzerain of Beam and Talon, it said with unaccustomed brevity. Tell my peer that I wish a colloquy at once.
One of the fluffy quadrupeds bowed at once, then scurried off to call the commander of the armed forces. The suzerain of propriety stood still upon its perch, disallowed by custom from setting foot upon the surface until the ceremonies of protection had been completed. Its weight shifted from time to time, and it rested its beak on its chest while standing deep in thought. Part 4. Traitors. Accuse not nature, she hath done her part. Do thou but thine. John Milton, Paradise Lost. Chapter 50. Government in Hiding. The messenger sat on a couch in the corner of the council room, holding a blanket around his shoulders while he sipped from a steaming cup of soup. Now and then the young Chen shivered, but mostly he looked exhausted. His damp hair still lay in tangled mats from the icy swim that had brought him on the last leg of his dangerous journey. It's a wonder he made it here at all, Megan On Eagle thought, watching him. All the spies and recon teams we sent ashore, carrying the finest equipment, none ever returned. But this little chim makes it to us, sailing a tiny raft made of cut trees with homespun canvas sails. carrying a message from my son. Megan wiped her eyes again, remembering the courier's first words to her after swimming the last stretch of underground caves to their deep island redoubt.
Captain Oneagle sends his felicitations, ma'am.
He had drawn forth a packet, waterproofed in ole tree sap, and offered it to her, then collapsed into the arms of the medical techs.
A message from Robert, she thought in wonder. He is alive. He is free. He helps lead an army.
She didn't know whether to exult or shudder at the thought. It was a thing to be proud of, for sure. Robert might be the sole adult human loose on the surface of Garth right now, and if his army was little more than a ragged band of simian guerrillas, well, at least they had accomplished more than her own carefully hoarded remnants of the official planetary militia had. And if he had made her proud, Robert had also astonished her. Might there be more substance to the boy than she had thought before? Something brought out by adversity, perhaps?
There may be more of his father in him than I'd wanted to see.
Sam Tennis was a starship pilot who stopped at Garth every 5 years or so, one of Megan's three spacer husbands. Each was home for only a few months at a stretch, almost never at the same time. Then off again. Other femmes might not have been able to deal with such an arrangement, but what suited spacers also met her needs as a politician and career woman. Of the three, only Sam Tennis had given her a child.
"And I never wanted my son to be a hero," she realized. "As critical as I have been of him, I guess I never really wanted him to be like Sam at all."
For one thing, if Robert had not been so resourceful, he might be safe now, interned on the islands with the rest of the human population, pursuing his playboy hobbies among his friends. Instead of engaged in a desperate, useless struggle against an omnipotent enemy.
"Well," she reassured herself, "his letter probably exaggerates.